Today in the Grave Talks, part two of our conversation with Jack Kenna about being closer to hell. Jack Kenna is a paranormal investigator, as well as an author, public figure, and adjunct teacher of his college courses on paranormal research. He is also an active paranormal investigator. Jack published several books, including Hauntings, Ghosts, and Demons. And then in June of 18, his second book, Paranormal Research. He's been involved in countless cases with the goal of helping and healing those paranormally affected. Today, we hear part two of his story on The Grave Talks. I want to talk about that, the possession case, a little bit. You don't have to get any names or locations or anything like that.
Oh, I can. Anyway,
I
can tell you a little bit.
Yeah, just generically of you know, what led up to the kind of diagnosis, if you will, that this person is possessed.
Well, I have studied demonology, and I have studied the different things you can do to see if somebody is under the influence of something negative. In this particular case, it was this woman's daughter. It started off with was really acting strange. She was under psychiatric, you know, help for things, and she had all these issues, and she had gone through something very horrific just a couple years before. I'll just say it was being raped by a family member.
And
a lot of times you find out people with these really negative things have that type of stuff in their past. It's really bad stuff. And so anyways, they had her on these psych meds and stuff like that, but they weren't doing anything for her. They weren't working at all. They kept trying to change them. She had spent a year going through that, and they had her on, but it wasn't doing anything for her. That is typically one of the first signs that there may be something else involved. It's not a guarantee, but there might be something else involved here, which is why the medications don't work, because they should. They really should. So one of the next things you can do is introduce yourself. You can put holy water on your hand. Now, these people were Catholic. So the trick there was you put holy water on your hand, and you shake the person's hand, and you see what their reaction is. So you do it before you go into the house. So I did that. And I'm talking to the mother, and then she introduces her daughter. She was like 15 at the time. And I said, "It's nice to meet you." I put my hand out. She just looks down at it and gives me a glare. She wouldn't even shake my hand. I'm like, "Okay, all right. May not be anything. All right,
sure."
Just typical teenager, you know. But we get talking to her, and she wouldn't say anything for the longest time. Then she started complaining about a headache, and then the attitude changed. Like, you could say this, okay, that could be psychological too. She became like a slightly different person, more like wanting to get you, to have you help her, and she would tell you about things that happened, her and her friends using this Ouija board, and she was, her and her friends were getting into casting spells, and she tried to cast a spell one time for protection to become a vampire so that nobody could ever hurt her again. And we found this out because her mother gave us her diary, and she said, "I want you to read it." So we read through it. It's like, okay. Now, I couldn't have done that without the mother's permission.
Sure.
But she gave it to us, you know, to do. And she goes, "I want you to," because she had already read it. And like, wow, okay. But this girl's idea of vampires was what you see on, you know, Twilight and all that, right? You know, not the evil things, the glittery whatever. But it was so nobody could ever hurt her again, right? Well, when you start asking for things like that, and you're using Ouija boards, and you're calling on these things to do that for you, negative things can come in, right? And
sure.
Suppose they give you what you want, right? But there's a price to be paid for that. So we went through all this. And then one of the other things I did, we investigated the house, caught basically nothing. We had no activity in the house while we were there at all, although the family would experience things. But while we were there, nothing, except one thing I caught on an SLS camera, this figure that was bouncing around in the dining room. And it would, anytime I get the camera on, it would disappear, it would just like take off and disappear. So I'm like, that's weird, strange. I tried to see if it was anything causing this figure or anything like that, and I couldn't narrow it down to anything because it was on a blank wall area. So I'm like, okay. So anyways, we come back, and this is when some of the first real serious stuff began. We show them what we found. The girl's sitting at the other end of the dining room table. It's like a six-seat table, dining room table. Her mother's sitting down next to her. My other investigator is sitting down on the other side of her. And she's like at the far end of the table from me. I'm at the other end. So I start showing this what we found and just the SLS thing. And all of a sudden, the minute I show it, the girl's eyes begin to glare. I mean, she gets angry. And I'm like, okay, that's an unusual reaction. Why are you getting angry at that?
Yeah.
You know, you think they'd be excited about it. So I'm like, okay, maybe there's something else going on here. So I had my little bag with because I was going to do some blessing in the house and stuff like that. I had my little bag in front of me, too, with some holy water, a cross, and a crucifix, I mean, and some other items in there. And so I had these small St. Benedict's medals. St. Benedict was an exorcist in the Catholic Church. Sure. I take one out, and they're blessed. And I said, I want you to have this. So I slide it down the table towards her, and she pushes away from the table. Her head goes down, her head comes back up, and her eyes are fully dilated now.
Oh, gosh.
This is in a lit room during the day with light coming in through the windows. Her eyes fully dilated. I'm like, okay. And my other investigator, Carly, is kind of looking at her, and she'll know she should back away from the table. So you got to play it cool. It's weird. You got to play it cool, and you go, no, what's the matter? Take the medal. I want you to have it. I think it'll be helpful. And she's just kind of growly says, take it away. Take it back. So I'm saying, well, okay. I pushed maybe too far sometimes because I go, well, I'll tell you what. If you can push it back to me, I'll take it back. And I'm thinking this thing's going to come flying across the table at me or something. It didn't happen. But I'm like, push it back to me and I'll take it back. And she wouldn't do it, right? She kept getting more angry and stuff. And I said, all right. So I had Carly take it away. And her mother was like, see, this is what happens. This is how she changes. And I'm like, well, okay. Well, we're going to go upstairs to her bedroom. We're going to do some stuff up there. So I said, we go upstairs. We start doing some blessings. She's still staying down in the dining room. And the girl is. And as I start blessing her room, we start hearing screaming. And things being thrown and everything else. And it's like, the mother's like, should I go down and check on her? I said, not yet. So I finished the blessing and all of a sudden you hear her pounding on the table down there and then it stops. And her mother goes down, checks on her, and we come down the stairs, Carly and I, and they're in the living room now and she's sitting on the couch and she's complaining about this horrible headache. I'm like, okay. I said, do you mind if I just check your forehead, see if you have a fever. And she said, yes, this is, I think, now the girl instead of the thing. And so the minute I had still holy oil on my hands from doing the blessings up in the thing. And I knew that.
Yeah.
So I put my hand on her head and she starts screaming that it burns and that her headache's getting worse. So I just, okay, take my hand away. All right. So these are just tells. And there's no guarantee still that's what's going on.
But sure.
One of the best ones you can do is, I backed away and I just in my head started saying the Hail Mary prayer.
Yeah.
In my head. She reacts to it. The minute I start saying it in my head, the girl starts reacting that her head is burning and her, you know, her headache is like it feels like her head's gonna explode and all that. And the minute I stop, it starts to get better. So I did it twice. Same thing happened twice. Yeah. Nobody knew I was saying that prayer. Because I wasn't speaking it out loud.
Yeah.
So that once that happened, and there was other things that happened in between. This took a year and a half, by the way, to figure out.
Wow.
It's not something you figure out in a week.
Yeah, this wasn't all during an afternoon. It was.
I mean, we kept going back there and do it and checking on things probably 10 times over a year and a half and talking to them on the phone and stuff like that in that period of time. Year and a half to finally go to my friend who is an exorcist and say, Steve, I think I need your help with this one. Mm-hmm. And I sat down and talked to him and he's like, Yeah, okay, we're going tomorrow.
Wow.
I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Now he is an exorcist.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah. He goes, she's possessed. We're going tomorrow. So I'm like, okay. And we did. And 13 hours later, he finally finished. We had to go back twice more for some extra follow up on that.
Yeah.
But 13 hours initially to do the exorcism. And then Carly and I stayed till like 3 a.m. before we actually left the house, just to make sure everything was okay.
So you've been coming and going from there for a year, and you finally bring an exorcist in.
Talked to an exorcist and let him decide.
Yeah. Well,
I don't
sure,
bring him in.
Yeah. Sure. You, and then he said, let's go. Yeah. What occurred? How did that visit go?
It went real quick initially because Steve's like, I'm just not going to let her know who I am. But when he did walk in, she goes, the girl says, what the F are you doing here?
Okay.
And he's like, well, I just came here to talk to you. And she goes, no, you came for more than that. So at that point, it's not really the girl.
Yeah.
What happens in possessions is that person is pushed aside. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're like pushed into a black hole almost, and the demon is taking over. So that person can see everything that's going on, which is why they sometimes have memories of things. But they can't do anything. They're not in control of their own body.
They're just kind of along for the ride almost.
They're along for the ride. Yeah. And they're separate. You know, they're almost, some exorcists will tell you they're basically outside their body. Right. And this thing is fully in control.
But
it can stay there as long as it wants.
Is that so, all of the time while they're possessed? Or is it just kind of like over that year that you were coming and seeing her? Was there plenty of time during the days where she's herself and doing her thing? But like the possession kind of.
Yeah,
just,
at times. I mean, it doesn't always stay there. I mean, it can when it wants to.
Okay.
And it can do it whenever it wants, and it can stay as long as it wants. Because there'd be times like when we weren't there, like her mother would say, she's been like this for a week.
Yeah.
So that thing is just totally in possession.
Sure.
You know, it's taking care of her life. In fact, I remember the first time we were there, and the girl was actually at, we'll just call it Four Winds. We went to see her mother, and she, her daughter called her from the facility, and I'm like, oh, okay. She goes, oh, it's my daughter is calling me from the facility. So she answers, she goes, hello. First thing your daughter says to her is, what are those people doing there?
Yeah.
She didn't even know we were there.
But she, something did. Yeah.
Something did. I mean, it's weird things like that. So when you have to collect all this, which is why it took a year and a half. You collect all this information. Then I go to my friend who's the exorcist, and I present all that to him and let him decide, do you want to do something here, or do we need to do more?
Yeah.
You know, and the thing was the thing we found out at the very end, because it actually jumped from the daughter to the mother, because none of us realized the mother had said during the exorcism, I guess just in her own mind, you know, come into me and leave my daughter alone.
Oh, just kind of like the other story.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it will do that when it's when it's under stress of being, you know, thrown out, it'll jump to somebody who asks it to.
Yeah.
It'll sometimes jump to somebody he thinks is weak enough that it can take over.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, these are really different. They're completely different than hauntings.
Yeah.
You know? But but what happened, what we found out in the end was, and it was actually the mother that was finally exorcised from, in that last 5 hours.
Oh.
Of the thing. Yeah. Cause it jumped, and then, we didn't know it at the time. And then something else happened, and we realized, okay, it's actually still here. It's in the mother. So, so we kept doing the exorcism on her at the very end. When it was finally gone, she goes, Steve is talking to her, and he's saying, you know, it's okay. You're going to be okay. And she goes, no, you don't understand. I'll never be forgiven, and God will never forgive me for the things I've done. And all. And we're like, what are you talking about? What God, you're getting the rite of exorcism, and you're getting, you gave her, shortly after that, he did give her the rite of communion and all that. And she's like, no, I killed myself when I was 17. We're like, never told us this. Like, she never told me and my team that. She goes, when I was 17, I cut my wrist. I committed suicide. I died and went to hell. This is what she told. I died and went to hell. Now I'm listening. I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. She goes, I think Steve said, well, he goes, what was hell like? Because there is actually demons who have described to other exorcists what hell really is. Mm-hmm. She goes, it was just an absence of everything. It was pitch darkness. All you hear is the screams of the tormented, and you are disconnected, and you know that you're disconnected from God and everything. And that's actually how hell is described by demons. It's the absence of everything.
It sounds like a roller coaster in the dark that I would hate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and there's nobody there to help you if it's going off the track.
Yeah, you just hear the screams of the people above.
You're all alone.
So yeah, hell is basically hell is Space Mountain, essentially, is what we're saying.
I never went on Space Mountain. I don't like those things. So I never went. If that's what it looks like, I don't want to go.
Exactly.
I never went on Space Mountain. Yeah. But think of it, just pitch darkness. Nothing. Yeah. You can't see anything, but you can hear the screams of the tormented and the demons but nobody's there's no help. She goes, I kept praying to God to forgive me while I was there. And then all of a sudden they brought me back. The doctors couldn't explain how they brought her back. She was dead. Uh-huh. They were getting ready to give up. And then she came back. And I'm like, I know what happened. I said, God didn't bring you back. Demon brought you back, because demons are in hell too, and they don't want to be there either.
Okay.
To be honest with you.
Yeah.
They want out. They've told other exorcists this. They don't want to be in hell either. They created it, but they don't want to be there. Right. So what I think happened was she's reaching out probably to anything really to try to bring her back from that void, and something did.
Yeah.
It brought her back, and it stayed with her all her life. Because she said after after that experience, after that moment in her life, everything, her life was horrible. Everything was downhill.
Yeah.
You know, she stayed to her faith. I think that's the only thing that kept her from probably committing suicide herself. She stayed to her faith and prayed every day and kept her Bible with her. But like, she was supposed to inherit like this pretty good sized fortune, and one of her cousins stole it from her.
Wow.
Or her uncle. I was sorry, not a cousin. Yeah, her uncle stole it from her. She never got any of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then there was other things. Her husband she married was very abusive, and all this stuff was, and that led to what happened with her daughter and all these kind of things.
Sure.
She just described all these horrific things all of her life to us. I'm like, yeah, yeah. But I think what happened was it never really totally got possession of her because of her strong faith.
Yeah.
But when her daughter had that experience and she reached out to this, she went this other way to start spell casting and all this other negative stuff, it went to her.
Yeah.
And found its way in.
So then it jumped
when the mother said, you know, hey, you know, leave my daughter alone to come to me, it jumped into her. And I think only because it was during the course of the exorcism.
Sure.
Right. Because it wanted out.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want to go through that either. It's painful to them. Mm-hmm. But it had a chance to go someplace else, so it went. So, and it left the daughter. So, but these things, and this is with people, you have to always explain to them after. You have to stay with your faith. This thing will always keep trying to come back.
Yeah.
Which is why we had to go back a few more times and do some other minor rites and stuff. I helped Steve out with that. He went back and I just assisted him with it. To do some other minor rites to try to keep them on track and keep that thing from trying to come back in. So, the way it is with a possession case.
Tell me about what it was like and what you witnessed in terms of someone physically changing. What did you see happen?
Right at the end. And there was seven of us there. We all saw at the very end, as a demon was being cast out, you could say, her stomach distended outward like a balloon. Okay. Her neck did the same thing. Her facial features changed. And then there was a loud scream and everything went back to normal.
Wow.
That's the only way I can describe it.
When you see something like that happen, I mean, you'd almost assume, I mean, if there was a medical reason that it was going on, there would be some sort of bruising or some sort of, right, you know, showing right. that, you know, this just occurred. Was there anything like that when she went back to normal, showing that her body went through some sort of trauma?
No. No bruising, no nothing. Oh. She felt exhausted
and sure.
sore, but that's from all the other stuff that goes along with an exorcism, yeah. too. Because this thing is fighting. You had four big guys holding this woman down. A woman who probably weighed about 140 pounds.
Wow.
Big guys trying to hold her down. Same for the daughter when she was possessed. Here's a 15-year-old girl that four guys could barely hold down.
Yeah.
You know,
what was going through your mind as you walked out of that house at 3 a.m. that day?
I'm tired. I want to go home and go to bed.
Shit, and I want to go to bed. When you woke up the next
morning, I was like, thank God this is over. I want to go home and go to bed.
When you woke up the next morning and kind of started to look at and reflect on what had just happened.
You know what I did? Yeah. I went to my computer and I wrote it all down.
Good idea.
Everything from the beginning of the case. Well, I had been taking notes during the case anyway. Yeah. But after that, I actually went to my computer and wrote everything down that happened during the course of the actual exorcism. Just for my own edification.
Yeah.
Like say, all right, I really did experience this. This really did happen. Even though, there's seven of us there. We all know what happened. Mm-hmm. I wanted to document it just for myself, if nothing else. And just to get my head wrapped around it, really. Because at the time, I mean, for me anyway, and I know for Steve and even for Carly, we weren't scared of anything.
Yeah.
You're not thinking that way. You're thinking trying to help this poor woman and this her daughter. You know, that's all you're thinking about.
Sure.
And I did I did post on my Facebook page at the time to everybody. I didn't tell them where we were or anything. Just told them what was going on and to everybody to just sit down during this period of time and pray. Say a prayer for the woman and her daughter. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped. Because now you've got like at least hundreds of people. Because I got quite a good following, so you at least had hundreds of people praying for this family. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if they know who they are or they, because I didn't give out names, nothing like that. I just said this is what's going on. If you could pray for this family, it'd be helpful, you know. And I think that helped. But you're just focusing on everything you're doing, And that's all you do, right? And the next day, you feel it. I mean, you're exhausted.
Sure.
I mean, I was probably exhausted for about a week.
Yeah.
You know, because it takes a lot out of you, just emotionally, spiritually, mm-hmm. energy-wise, because you're putting all your efforts and energy into it. So you're tired. You're exhausted. And then you reflect on it later. And it's like, okay, what really happened there? What went on?
Sure.
What did you experience? So that's why actually the next day I did sit down at my computer and write the whole thing down. I still have it, you know, I still have it. And no, I will not be writing a book about it.
It would make a good one.
But, you know, well, funny thing was I've got a couple books out there. One book I wrote is just kind of a fun read and it's kind of a paranormal horror story. It was before that case ever happened. Mm-hmm. And I did put in a demonic case in there, which was just totally made up at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's not similar to what we went through, but it is other things. It is things that have happened in other types of cases, at least how the people who are possessed react, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Not everything that happens, but because some of it obviously is written for just entertainment purposes.
Sure.
But, you know, the rest of it, like sometimes things that happen and possessed items and things like that, how something comes into somebody's life is real. I mean, those things do happen. So it talks about that.
When it comes
and
to
I may write a story someday similar to what happened.
Sure.
But it will not have anybody's name and it will not be exactly the same.
Sure.
You know. But I did document it. And someday that'll go somewhere to somebody else. But
when it comes to like items and things of that nature, like possessed items, as one would look at, what is that? And why would there be something dark attached to an object if it's just an inanimate object?
Well, sometimes things with demonics, they don't possess an item.
Okay.
They utilize it to make you think it's possessed.
Okay.
Like they'll move it around. They don't want to, like with the dolls, right? Stuff like that, sure. With Annabelle and all that. Even the Warrens would have told you the doll itself isn't necessarily possessed, but it's being used by the demon. Mm-hmm. And it may be attached to it, but it's not possessing it. Because it wants to use that item in order to get to somebody, right? But other items can have attachments to them. They're not necessarily possessed. They have attachments to them of a spirit. Now, it could be, typically they're just a human spirit that item had a lot of real meaning to it.
Sure.
And it was important to them, and it still is. And I have my whole theory about this that, okay, it does have an attachment by something. Mm-hmm. Somebody can curse an item too, and that's just something different. That's a cursed item. That's,
sure.
That's something completely different. And that's where spells are used to put a curse on something or a person or things like that. But an item with an attachment, I don't think it's the actual complete soul of the person. I think it's a part of the soul of the person that's left behind. Mm-hmm. I have my own theory. I call it, you ever seen the Harry Potter shows?
Sure.
Movies, all that? All right. I call it my Voldemort theory.
Okay.
Where you can leave part of yourself behind with something, mm-hmm. which actually Voldemort was kind of doing that. He was doing things to like split his soul, to leave part of his soul attached to an item so he could come back later on. Mm-hmm. So technically, I mean, that was a great idea. And I think maybe J.K. Rowling was into a little bit of the paranormal stuff and stuff like that, why she knew that. So, but I think that's what happens. Part of your soul gets left behind because this item was so important to you. So you've attached part of yourself to it while you were alive. Because maybe you wore it all the time. Could be a ring, could be,
sure.
You know, just an item of clothing, something like that. But it was so part of your life that part of you is attached to it. When you pass on, that part of you stays behind with it. So now, if somebody disrespects that item or whatever, gets control of that item or possession of that item, they may have things happen around it, right? So I did have an item that was a knife one of our clients had. It had been used in World War I and World War II. It killed people, you know, the person who used it to kill people with. So he was having strange activity happen around it, seeing dark shadow figures and stuff like that. So I did take it from him. He offered it to me. I took it and I blessed it and did some things to it. And I left it in my back porch for like a month and nothing happened. If somebody gives me something like that, I'll either leave it in my garage, mm-hmm. or I'll leave it in my back porch and see if anything strange happens. I won't bring it right into the house. So
you don't put it on
like
your
I'll listen
stand.
For is yeah. Do I hear movement out in my garage and I go out and nobody's there?
Sure.
Do I, you know, hear weird I've never had anything happen.
Okay.
And with several different items I've gotten, which I've given away, by the way. But I've never had anything happen to them. And the people I gave them to have never had anything happen to them. I think it comes to a point like if you blessing or do some what they call binding prayer and stuff like that to things, I think it quiets down. And I think it also has to do with the person who has it. If they have a lot of chaos or, you know, chaotic energy in their life, I think these things are attracted to that and they play out more. You know what I'm saying? They act up more. So whereas somebody is who's, you know, okay with their life and things are doing well, the thing doesn't act up at all. You know, I've seen that.
Sure.
And I think that's just the energy you're giving off. It doesn't react to your energy. You know, it reacts to chaos, more chaotic energy. And that was what was happening in all those cases where somebody gave me something. Right. So, again, I did do bless these items and stuff like that. And you know, eventually I give them to somebody who likes to collect that stuff and knows how to handle it.
Sure.
So, Because I know enough people in the paranormal. So I just give them away. I don't like to keep them. So
does it
in fact, I did have the Ouija board from that possession case.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. I don't have it anymore. And there was nothing, actually nothing came off of it. I mean, I had blessed it at the house at the time when the mother gave it to me. Sealed it and, you know, put holy water on it and different things like that. I don't think the actual demon came through the board anyway. I think it utilized the board to get to the daughter.
Sure.
So it's not like she conjured it through the Ouija board. It was already there. It just used that as a means to get to the daughter.
Okay.
But just to be on the safe side, you know, we bless these things and stuff like that. I have it. I actually gave it to a couple of friends of mine who have their own haunted collection kind of thing. They go around the country with it and stuff like that. So, and I gave them some information. Actually, I gave them this part of the story behind it. So somebody else has part of that story now of what happened. No names, still again, no names of the people or not even the actual location. Just it's Southern New York. Mm-hmm. That's all. So they're taking it around to their shows and stuff now. And it's like, you know, it's not haunted anyway, but I don't believe it is, but they have.
Yeah. When it comes,
but it did come from that actual case, so it's interesting.
When it comes to haunted objects and things like that, and your theory of, you know, you leave a little bit of your soul behind to pieces or things that meant a lot to you, do you necessarily have to be dead for those objects to then do something or to manifest energy?
I don't think you do. Yeah, no, that's a great question. I kind of interrupted you, so if you want
to... No, go ahead. That is the question. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that idea.
I don't think you need to be dead. And there's a reason I say this. There was a Ghost Adventure show that where there was this one location they were at, and somebody else owned it now. I think it was a restaurant or a bar or something. I can't remember. But anyways, a gentleman had been murdered in the basement there. By this guy he had hired to work for him. But I guess he was harassing the guy who was working for him. And that guy finally snapped and he killed the guy with a hammer.
Oh, wow.
And the strange thing is, right, the owner guy is dead. But people see an apparition of the guy who killed him, who's in jail. He's not dead. He's in jail for the murder.
Yeah.
But people see his apparition in the basement.
What is that then?
I think it's that whole Voldemort theory thing. Part of his soul is left there.
Is it
because it was such a traumatic event, and there was so much energy put into that traumatic event.
But is it a conscious version of his soul, or is that more of the?
It may not be energy. Because he doesn't seem to interact when people see him, but they do say it looks like he's looking at them. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. I couldn't tell you if it's sentient or not, but he did leave something there.
Yeah,
you know. And today, if they see him, I believe that's part of his soul that's left behind. So maybe it will interact at some point. Maybe when he's gone, when he does pass on. You know, I don't know. But you can attach something of yourself to items even when you're alive. And I think that's when it happens. Like I said, I think that's what's happening when you have a ring or something you really love and you wear it a lot and stuff like that. You're creating that attachment all that time that you're alive.
Sure.
Right. Then when you pass on, part of you is still attached to it, you know? Some people can feel the energy off of things, and they can read a lot about the person who owned it.
Yeah.
Because their energy is still attached to it, or part of them is still attached to it.
Is that, does everyone do that naturally to an object? Like, let's say it's a wedding ring or whatever it may be. So when you go to, let's say you go to the antique store and you want to buy an old ring there, is it virtually all of those, as long as they were, you know, worn and loved, they're all going to have something attached to it?
I think so. I mean, you may not notice anything from it, but I think the energy is still attached to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or part of the, I think the difference is sometimes it's just energy that's attached to that person's energy. Sometimes it's actually, it was almost like an obsession to the person. So now their soul is attached to it.
Okay. Right?
And it can be a good obsession. I mean, obsessions aren't really good, but you know, it can be a positive thing. It's like, I really love this ring, you know, and blah, 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 or this watch, or oh, this piece of furniture, this rocking chair that I spent all my time in. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever. It could be anything, right? So, yeah, I think there is always something attached to these things in these stores. You know, whether you have anything happen after you buy it or not, it's hard to say. You know, again, I think that has to do with the person's energy who buys it.
Sure.
You know, if it's, if, like I said, if it's more chaotic energy, or let's say it's a polar opposite of the energy that's attached to that thing, you may have experiences. I think if the energy is closer to the energy of the item, your energy is closer, you may not notice anything.
Sure.
Because it's found a new home, in other words. Mm-hmm. It's happy there. If it's not happy there, you may have things happen. So that's just my own personal thoughts on things. But
sure. Yeah. I know you teach a course at your local college about the paranormal. How did that start?
Actually, it was something after I got back into the paranormal and started doing all that and started connecting more with my own abilities again and stuff like that. It's something I really wanted to do. And I didn't know if it would ever happen, but I did write my book. It's just a paranormal 101 course, but I wrote my book. It's called, oh my God, my mind just went blank. I can't remember my own book's name.
I've done it myself.
It's called Paranormal Research. A comprehensive guide to building a strong team.
Sure.
And it's about team building and the process you go through if you want to work with clients and things like that. So I wrote the book hoping that someday I would be able to teach a course with it. So even had it done when I was talking to my publisher, I went through Schiffer Publishing and they're like, do you want this in paperback or hardcover? I said, oh, hardcover. Because I'm thinking of the old textbooks, right?
Sure.
You
know? Yeah.
So, but I try to make it a fun read too. I mean, it's not just all technical, all this. I give my own thoughts on things. I try to be a little bit more interactive in the writing with it. Mm-hmm. So it's more enjoyable to read rather than just facts. And because I've read different books on, they're just too technical, you know, they're too dry, you know.
Yeah.
Try to make mine a little bit more interesting, which at the back of the book is several investigations our team actually did. The actual investigations, what actually happened, how we went about it, how we approached it, what we got out of it, you know, and I actually interviewed some of the team members on their thoughts from that case, how it impacted them, you know, whether emotionally or how it changed their life a little bit, you know, or their thoughts on things and things like that. So we cover all that, but we cover equipment. We cover talking with spirits, the approach to take when doing that. Because there's a physical approach to it too, to being more open, showing that you're open to trying to communicate rather than, you know, just sitting there arms crossed and saying, you need to talk to me. You know, you don't want to take that approach. You want to take a more open approach. Like, hey, I'm here to talk to you with your kind of your arms open and things like that. We talk about that. We talk about spiritual protection, what to do to protect yourself spiritually. Mm-hmm. Because investigating, you know, what we're talking about is a spiritual realm. It's not just all equipment, right? It's not just all, you know, electronics. And I always tell people, what do you think you're talking to?
Yeah.
And they just... I get the deer in the headlights look. Usually when I ask that question, it's like, I go, do you believe you have a soul? Oh, yeah. What do you think you're talking to?
Sure.
Oh, a person's soul. Yes. There you go. You're talking to a human soul. So it's not just something in the dark that you can't put your finger on. If you believe you have your soul, that's what you're trying to communicate with, another soul, right? They just don't have their body anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. So we talk about all these things. We go through all that. And we just give them some basics on investigating. We actually conduct an investigation during part of the course as an actual investigation portion, which shows them how to do all of the stuff we're talking about, how to use the equipment, how to approach talking to spirits, how to, you know, keep yourself focused, follow a train of thought when you're asking questions. Just don't ask random things. If you think you're getting activity when you start talking about something, try to stay with that train of thought, you know, and rather than saying, oh, you know, was this your home? Do you like this? And then go, you know, did you spend a lot of time in this room? And then go, what's your favorite color?
Yeah.
All right, you just went off track. They may not talk to you anymore. Sometimes just talking amongst yourselves can elicit reactions from things. You know,
almost
they may not want to be talked to, but yeah, they may want to join in the conversation.
Yeah, I was just going to say, just they want to, as one would when they're alive, like, oh, right. I have a comment. I have an opinion on what you're talking about there.
Yeah, yeah. We get more reactions doing investigations doing that than just trying to ask questions, you know.
Do you try and aim the conversations to be of something that would elicit a response? Something that someone would be passionate about?
Yeah, I mean, there's what I try to do is use the history of what I know of the location and the people that supposedly, you know, that did live there at one time. Mm-hmm. A lot of times that's historical sites. You can do that easy with historical sites. With more residential cases, it can be a little bit tougher. But like historical sites, here's one we did in Massachusetts. It was Fisher College, actually, which used to be an old mansion that they bought. And the word was that the wife of the man who lived there, the woman, was a mean woman. Nobody liked her. And because they were originally from New York and they didn't like them because they were living in Boston now. So I used that at one point in the library where people reported, and even security reported, seeing this woman walking through the library on the security cameras. And they'd go up there and nobody was there. Mm-hmm. So like, oh, okay, I wonder if that's Mrs. King. King was the name of the family that owned it originally. So I'm like, okay, so I'm like, well, Mrs. King, you know, I heard you're a mean woman. Nobody liked you. Nobody came to your wake. Baba. And me and the other guy that were in there, the other investigator, we hear this woman scream, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, what the hell? So we thought it was maybe one of my other investigators.
Yeah.
So we went out. We went out through the doors to the library, and you go down a stairway. There's a stairway going down. Some people were down there. I said, did you girls scream or something? Anybody scream? No. They didn't even hear it, right? And so I called up to two people on the floor above us. They didn't scream or anything. They didn't hear anything. Like, this was really loud. So we play back the recorder just to listen to it. And right at where we heard the scream, there's this woman's voice saying, they liked me. And it turns out when we actually dug into the history, the school had the history of the family all wrong. They weren't from New York. They were from Boston. And actually, they were very well liked in the community. And she was a daughter of the Revolution because her great, great, great grandfather had been in the Battle of Bunker Hill.
Okay.
So, wow. You know, yeah. So you give them all the finally for the college, we give them all the final truth information on the family that lived there and stuff. And it's like, well, no wonder they were having problems. You guys had their history all wrong.
Yeah.
You know? So, but that was a reaction.
That's interesting. And I wouldn't say that's provoking. It's more like, I'm going to go in and politely have an interview with you. And I may ask questions or I may say statements that you may not like.
Or provocative.
Yeah, provocative. Yeah. Yeah. They're not there to, to truly upset, but it's set the record straight. If this is wrong, this is what the legend or the lore is, and you know it's different. Tell me.
And we didn't know if it was true or not.
Sure.
I mean, I do look at that as provoking.
Yeah.
It's the proper way to provoke.
Yeah.
By just using the stories that you've been told about the family or about the location that may or may not be true. Right. So you are provoking someone.
Yeah.
But you're not like screaming and yelling at them and demanding and swearing at them. You're not doing that. You're just using the history. And we actually talk about this in the class too, as part of the way to communicate with spirit. There is a proper way to kind of instigate in order to get a reaction, hopefully, and find out the truth. Because really that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to find out, why are you haunting this location? What's going on here? What's happening? Mm-hmm. Right? This is what I hear. Is this true? You know?
And, sure.
You know, people get mad, right? Yeah. They're still just people. So they still, if they're still interactive, if this is an actual human spirit that still exists and is learning and remembering, it's going to interact with you when you get something wrong about it, especially sure. that bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sure. I'm going to set the record straight.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. And then you do the research and find out, yeah, she's right. They liked her in that community, you know? Mm-hmm. They really liked her a lot. And that family did a lot for that community. So, interesting. Yeah, it is the proper way, if you want to talk about provoking, it is a proper way to provoke a response.
That wraps up our conversation with Jack Kenna. A big thank you to him for joining us on the program and sharing his experiences with us. We could not do this without you supporting the program and keeping us on the air. So a big thank you to you as well. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.